And hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new show heard right here on the Red Fox Blogger. And this is Islamic Issues with your host, Vlad Tepes. He will be joining us momentarily, and I am so very excited about this brand new program. Vlad Tepes hails from Canada. He is, of course, the prolific blogger that you can visit at vladtepesblogspot.com. This is rather exciting that I can convey to you. I bring so many people together, and I don't do it alone. It's important that we all have communal voices within the Radio Jihad counter-movement, as it were. There is a threat out there, people. It is called Islam. I want to play something for you right now, though. And this is rather lengthy. It's 8 minutes long, but believe me, it's worth your time. This is Vlad Tepes speaking with John Council of CFRA. And here we go.
Donato. Hi, James. What's on your mind?
Well, there's two things on my mind, actually, that are really concerning me, and I just want to know if I'm the only one who finds.
First of all, how's your cold?
Well, it's better than it was. Thanks. It should be gone. But I can't believe it still. It's like 2 weeks. Like, what the hell? Anyway.
We need you talking clear,
sir. Thanks. So here's the two stories, and these are really concerning me. I think there's a lot. They're worthy of thought because the implications of both of these, I think, are huge. One is about a couple in a London, England bus, right? So men, husband, wife, and they had an autistic child. And to keep the child calm, they were singing the child's favorite song to it, which was the Peppa Pig, which is a popular kids cartoon TV show in the UK, right? Peppa,
okay.
P-E-P-P-A, Peppa Pig, right? Anybody can look it up, and they can see episodes online or whatever. Just a stupid kid show. Anyway, they were singing the Peppa Pig theme song, which is a little catchy little tune, and Peppa Pig, and a couple of snorting sounds. A Muslim woman on the bus felt that it was offensive to her because somehow it was offensive to have references to pigs being sung near her, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she complained to the driver, who agreed and threw them off the bus and made them walk 2 miles. So just to be clear, the driver
kicked
threw
off the bus for singing a song.
For singing a song of a popular UK kids show. I mean, Peppa Pig is huge, okay? It's a big TV show in the UK. It's not like some little obscure thing no one's heard of. And the fact that the Muslim woman felt she had a right to complain because the song contained references to pigs, it's not quite exactly the same as forcing somebody to eat something, is it?
Boy, what would have happened if you had a little 2-year-old kid and they were barefoot and you're doing this little piggy went to market with their toes?
Well, it would be the exact same thing. And they were kicked off a bus 2 miles away from home, okay? Now, the fact that the driver agreed and said you're best to get off the bus, that's like...
And it was just one woman that was complaining?
Yes. So what we're seeing here is an act of what I would call Islamic or Sharia supremacy, which is actually of more importance than the Oklahoma beheading. We're talking about the complete subjugation of an entire culture and a people on rational foreign rules that are being imposed, but on mere whims, right? Well, I don't like the fact that they're singing a song that has a pig in it. What does that have to do with a dietary requirement and a voluntary one at that? It's not even about an allergy, but even if it was, if you were allergic to nuts and somebody was singing a song next to you about nuts, do you feel you have a right to throw that? Even if that allergy was fatal, it's still a song. So I just think that this is not getting the attention it deserves in the press because people are focused on the spectacular and the sensational. They don't realize that that's not always what's going to have the biggest effect on them.
Well, that's a pretty sensational and spectacular story, though.
It is in my mind. And okay,
it's just coming from another perspective that probably doesn't have the attention of, you know, a culture here, at least here in Canada, that has lost its understanding between good and evil.
Well, you know, you could say that. I think that's completely reasonable. I'm much more open to certain things than I used to be. Anyway, more about that another time, on a Wednesday maybe. But The second story that's really, that I feel also is of considerably more magnitude and importance than I think it's being given, is about a mosque that's in Cape Town, South Africa. So this guy opened a mosque, and it's a progressive mosque. It's where women, men, and homosexual people can also...
I've read about it.
Now, the fact that local area Muslims were upset because it completely flies against all doctrine and orthodoxy of Islam. So they forced it to close. Now, granted, a city council or whatever closed it on the totem of it not meeting whatever plumbing or whatever ridiculous rules. But it's clear if you read the news stories about it and watch the interviews of people related, it's pretty clear that they closed it because local area Muslims felt that this did not meet Islamic standards, that it's not in keeping with the core values and dogma and doctrine.
Well, they closed
scripture.
It for doctrinal issues.
Yes. Now, okay, so we can agree. If we agree that they closed it for doctrinal issues, and if we agree then, and we can see that Muslims in an area can then say, you know what, if this is not teaching Islamic doctrine, we're going to close that mosque down, then how does that explain all of the mosques all over the world that preach terrorism, sedition, genocide, treason, a hatred of the other, Islamic supremacy? In other words, how is it that people can be denying, groups like CARE and so on, can be denying that Islam contains these teachings when we've now seen the minute that a liberal or progressive mosque opens up, it gets closed by area Muslims? We now know that there is no mosque that's open and working that does not teach doctrine. You follow?
Ask Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, well, I'm not...
He needs to have a handle on that.
Yeah, I'm not confident that I'm going to get a meaningful answer.
Okay, I got a couple things to ask you, James, because I know, the research that you do, and I just got sent a tweet by somebody, okay? And I'm very questioning the veracity, the authenticity of this tweet, and you'll know why when I quote it to you. And I replied to this person that has about 2,500 followers on Twitter, and I said, sources, please, okay? Because, if you're going to put something out like that, I mean, you've got to tell me what the source is. Because I need more than just a Photoshopped picture and a quote here, okay? And here's the quote. If you know anything about this quote, James, they're supposedly, and I say supposedly, quoting the Prime Minister of Turkey, Erdogan, okay? Mm. The guy's last name is Erdogan. And they quote him as saying, the term moderate Islam is ugly and offensive. There is no moderate Islam. Islam is Islam. Have you ever seen that quote attributed to Erdogan?
Not just that quote, but several quotes. Actually, Erdogan, not that it's a big deal, but it's pronounced Erdogan. He's actually made several very similar quotes. And by the way, he's quite correct.
You would trust the veracity of that quote there without knowing the source where it came from. You've heard
absolutely.
That, seen that quote before.
Well, that exact one, no, but I've read many in Hürriyet, like in the major Turkish media. I've read many similar quotes, and the one he's most famous for is the one where he reads an ancient Islamic poem about how Islam will take over, how the mosques are the barracks, how the minarets are their bayonets, and how the Muslims are their soldiers. I mean, Erdogan, you got to understand what this guy's about. He is a classic Muslim Brotherhood supremacist. He's and the only thing between him, the difference between Erdogan's Turkey and the Islamic State, is that they have a distinct difference about who's supposed to be the caliph, who's going to be the new caliph, right? He wants it to be him. But you have to look at Turkey before he took over. It was illegal to wear a hijab at a school, at a university for women, and now it's mandatory. And he just passed a law a few days ago saying that women will have to study Quran. And if I'm not, I'll have to go back and check the article to be sure, but I think it's become much more difficult for women to study anything else but Quran.
So you're saying Turkey has taken a definite step towards, would you call it Islamic extremism?
Toward Islam. He said it. He said it himself.
The media likes to refer to it as that.
Yeah, but Erdogan finds that offensive. He says it's Islam or not Islam. And all the evidence agrees with him. I don't like finding myself on the side of these guys. But the facts are the facts. And I don't really think lying about it or pretending it's something else or adding suffixes like ism or ist, I don't think it helps anybody's case. We're going to have to look at this thing and make some decisions. If you read the Quran, I'm sure you have, and if you read all of these different scriptures from which they draw the authority of and read Sharia law, you know what is and what is not Islam. And Erdogan isn't lying. He's telling it like it is. And yes, he did. He does. That particular quote you're referring to, I can't say with total authority if that's absolutely word for word correct.
But you're saying it is typical of his ideology, and you wouldn't be surprised at all that he did say it.
I'd be surprised if he didn't. He said many similar things.
Thank you, James.
My pleasure.
Good talking to you. 521-825.
And with that, I am very happy as the proprietor of the Red Fox blogger that Vlad Tepes is joining the family at the Red Fox blogger. And Vlad, welcome to your program.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I'm a couple minutes late. I'm just trying to, I guess if you try to do too much, you get nothing done, right? But the problem is that there's some very important stuff going on right now, and I'll try to go over some of the things I'm doing. There's a fellow who was an apostate from the mosque in Oklahoma, where the beheader is from, and he's had a few things to say. And I was helping to produce an interview with him and Robert Spencer, and I'm having some trouble getting the audio to work. But if I can get that finished editing, it's going to be a spectacular and very important interview. People really, really have to see this. And that might get done later tonight. And also, there's a conference going on in Warsaw that just wrapped up. And this conference called the OCSE or OSCE, basically it's like a hangover from the Cold War, right? The idea is that they created this way for diplomats and government officials and regular and NGOs, like various non-governmental organizations, to get together, and so that grievances could be aired about human rights in former Soviet states. Well, that has now become, it's been fairly hijacked by Islamist groups. The OIC, namely, or people acting on behalf of the OIC, and they're trying to implement various laws and rules across Europe about Islamophobia. And there's this entire theme of this particular conference was Islamophobia. Now, friends of ours like Elizabeth Wolfe and the inimitable and unique Stephen Coughlin, he's just the greatest fountain of knowledge about Islam and how it operates, in much the same way that Bill Warner, who's actually over there now too, and Robert Spencer is, but each of them has their own unique way of approaching it. And I've got a bit of a wrap-up from Elizabeth Wolfe and from Stephen Coughlin. I'm going to try to get that up sometime in the next 24 hours as well. But long story short, let's go back to these issues, these specific ones about the that I was addressing in that call to CFRA, okay? So I cannot emphasize enough how important I think what happened to that couple on that bus was, okay? Like, for one thing, trying to determine what the offense was is actually quite difficult because there is no rational grounds to determine what caused that driver to throw them off the bus. Now, the fact of the matter is the real crime was committed by the couple, not for singing a song, but for getting off the bus. They simply should not have done so. They should have stood up and said, "We haven't done anything wrong, and we're not." Mind you, if you have a screaming autistic child, I can see why it might not be the best time to stand your ground. On the other hand, a screaming autistic child might have been enough to have all the other people on the bus say, you know, shut up and drive and stand up with these guys. It's hard to say. I don't know. All I know is that it was an act of dimitude that concerns me greatly. Look, these people did not ask somebody who chose not to eat some food for some diet. You know, let's go right back to first principles here. If you actually read the freaking Quran, which is a god-awful read, it's difficult to get through, but it says in it, somebody asks the question to the pirate Mohammed that started all this nonsense. And they asked him, what about food? Should we, what food is forbidden to us and what food should we eat? And he said, because he was feeling like lazy that day, he didn't want to make up any rules, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I shouldn't drift into speculation when I'm talking about fact, but it's hard not to because this stuff is so annoying. What Mohammed said, according to Quran, is all that food which is consecrated for the people of the book is good enough for you. In other words, anything Christians or Jews can eat is fine for you, right? So, in other words, Quran says that Muslims can't eat pork. They can eat anything Christians can eat, and anything Jews can eat is okay for Muslims. He just didn't feel like making up any rules that day. So all of that stuff about, you know, halal food and so on, that kind of grew up as a, later on. That came later. But it's actually a political tool, right? It's not even in Quran, but let's just, even if it was, the fact is that a person's dietary choice is a choice. The term dietary choice has two words. Dietary, what you're eating, and choice, what you decide to eat and not eat. A person who has an allergy, well, they don't really have dietary choices. They have things that they can't eat or it will make them sick or kill them, right? Somebody has a seafood or a nut allergy, it's death. Now, if you were to go and feed somebody who had a food allergy, food that you knew would be dangerous to them, you're effectively poisoning them, you're guilty of a crime. If you were to feed somebody a food that they'd chosen not to eat, but there's no medical reason why they shouldn't, you're denying them their right to their medical, to their dietary choice. Now, you know, government does that to us all the time. What percentage of food on the grocery store shelves contain pork products that aren't listed? Or contain traces of, well, traces of nuts is always listed because that's a serious allergy. But what percentage of that food that you're looking at in the grocery store shelves is actually genetically modified? Well, the answer is almost all of it. Huge amount of it, right? I'm okay with GM food. I think it's the most greatest thing that ever happened in human history, practically, is GM food. It's a very, very good thing. But lots of people don't. And people have a right not to think, people have a right to think that GM food is, but they don't want to eat it. They might think it's bad. I think they're deluded. I think they're crazy, and I think they're selfish. I think they're really selfish, actually, because I think everybody that eats organic food is basically asking two other people to starve to death, because there's only enough arable land in the world to feed about 3 billion people if you go by organic farming methods. So if you're going to eat organic farming, you're really asking like 1.5 to 2 other people to die of starvation so that you get to eat your organic-ass strawberries, whatever. But they, be that as it may, other people have a right to disagree, okay? They have a right to say that, that GM foods is bad. But they're being tricked by government because it's in Canada, it's against the law to label a food a GM food. Follow? In other words, if I were to go into a grocery store in Canada with a whole bunch of stickers that I made up that said genetic, this food is a genetically modified food product, and I labeled them accurately, not lying, I could actually be arrested and go to jail for a crime because it's against the law to mark GM foods as GM foods. So the government actually gets to trick people who don't want to eat a thing based on their own personal choices. But the government tricks them into eating it anyway, right? However, if you were to trick a Muslim into eating pork product, well, you'd be denying them, whatever, their right to not eat pork. And I guess, and that would be, I could see that being a reasonable charge. You may as well charge, I mean, that would be, it's just wrong to do that. Like, people have a right to not eat whatever it is they don't want to eat for their own personal reasons. And sometimes they may be right. A person may decide an ingredient, they may do their own science and say, this ingredient isn't good for you, and I'm not going to eat that, and they, then they may be the only guy left standing, right? When the cancer hits or whatever. You know, most of the stuff is complete nonsense, but now and again it does happen. So fair enough. People do have that right, and it's a right that should be respected. But the right not to have somebody eat it beside you, that's not a right. Like if you've decided not to eat meat, if you're a vegetarian or a vegan, somebody's eating a ham sandwich next to you or a steak sandwich next to you, you just don't have a right. Like, you can move, but you don't have a right to tell that person they have to move. You don't have a right to tell a person they can't eat that thing. You have a right to try to convince them that they shouldn't. That's okay. It's goofy, but you got that right. But you absolutely don't have a right to tell that person that they cannot, because you've chosen not to. Your choice is your choice, and their choice is their choice. And that is all there is to it. Now, we have to move another level of abstraction away. If we can accept that, if we could somehow accept that they did have that right, we have to move another abstraction away to say, well, that person's talking about eating that food which you've chosen not to eat for reasons other than medical reasons, and say, well, they have no right to talk about ham because I've chosen not to eat ham for. Now we go another whole level of abstraction and say, this person on a public transport has not got the right to sing a little popular song to a TV theme for kids because it calms their kid down. They don't have that right because the words refer to a fictional character that happens to be made of the kind of meat that they're not allowed to eat. Now we've entered the level of that's so abstract. We're so far removed from any kind of real, conceivable victim in this crime that we're actually looking at something very different. Unconsciously, if anyone's listening to the show at all, unconsciously people already know what this is really about. This is about Muslims exerting a level of control where everybody has to make sure that every single thing they think, that they say, and that they present in public has to conform fully to Islamic sensibilities. It isn't about whether or not you're interfering with a Muslim's right to eat pork or not. You are actually like, okay, so what else have Muslims done? I think piggy banks are no longer given in British banks. I believe that in a British bank, you can no longer get, like they used to give piggy banks to kids, very old custom that dates back a really long time as a way of, for children to learn how to save money. Scottish police, a number of years ago, had a poster. On that poster, there was a black puppy dog, okay? And the puppy was sitting in a policeman's hat, and it was some, I don't know, community relations thing talking about how police dogs were being used in Scotland. And, the Muslims complained and had those ads pulled. You can't get those. They don't produce those posters anymore because Muslims objected to ink spilled on a piece of paper in the shape of a puppy because Muslims don't like dogs. Why? Because somewhere in Quran it says that an angel will never visit a house with a dog or a picture in it. Now, as it happens, that the pirate Mohammed, when he first took over the city of Yathrib, which is now called Medina, after he finished laying waste to Mecca, I believe he sent his army out to kill all the dogs in the city. Sent them out on a mission to just kill them all, including helper dogs and, disabled people who had dogs back then. It's funny because people talk about how the 7th century, like how Islam's trying to bring us all back to the 7th century. From what I've read, 7th century was okay. It was Islam that was a problem then too. Like, from what I've read, it was pretty multilateral, pretty tolerant, lots of different religions, people trading. Yeah, there was tribal warfare then like there is now. And yeah, there was some issues, but there's a lot of great thinkers, like Greece and Rome and Egypt, lots of Christian civilization, Jewish civilization were all thriving, as well as the Greek and Roman, and probably also the Persian civilizations were all thriving, and there was a lot of different cultures and, a lot of advancement, lots of movements in science, including in the Arabic world, but because the Arabs were all other than Islam at the time. And then along comes Islam, and when we think about the barbarism of the past, I'm beginning to wonder if it's all entirely because we're thinking about areas that have been conquered by and ruled under Islamic norms. So what are we seeing in terms of this family that got thrown off this bus? Well, we're seeing an act of absolute control by Muslims. They're saying this, that everything that takes place, one Muslim woman complained, the driver agreed and threw them off the bus 2 miles from home. That should be a crime. Those people, and the woman's got a right to complain about whatever she wants. Anyone can complain about anything. But the driver, now that there should be charges laid against that guy. Because he was certainly negligent of his duty, at least he should be fired from his job. I mean, if there wasn't an actual crime committed, throwing people off a bus for trivial reasons like that, you don't like the contents of their song. Talk about a violation of rights. That's a violation. If that's the reason that he threw them off the bus, and the papers all say so, that's a violation of his basic right of freedom of speech. Oh, my God. So the second issue was that I brought up in that clip was the one about the mosque in Cape Town, South Africa. Okay. This mosque was built and was going to be opened by a guy who was very much about, you know, like liberalism and progressivism, right? In fact, as far as I could tell, like the other fellow they interviewed, he wasn't the imam, but somebody else they interviewed who was somehow connected to the thing, was wearing like a Shea cap with the commie star on it and a hammer and sickle and yada yada, right? But the imam himself was clearly a progressive, you know? And that mosque was shut down lickety-split before it could even open, before they even sold their first prayer rug. That mosque was shut down by area Muslims. Why? Because it was not conforming to doctrine, to Islamic doctrine. And I think that's profoundly significant. Because you've got David Cameron and you've got Obama and you've got all these other leaders that are claiming that Islam is not Islam and that all these horrific actions we're seeing, these mosques that are preaching, have somehow been hijacked. Well, look, if Muslims are closing down a progressive mosque because it's not doctrinally correct, and they're not closing down all of these other mosques in which the 9/11 hijackings were planned, that mosque, the Blind Sheikh's Mosque in New York. And I could go on and on. You could list something like 80 or 88% of all mosques preach treason and sedition and genocide. And, you know, and no one, there's no movement by any group. CARE defends these. CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations, defends all these mosques. And, you know, no one's trying to get them closed down. So what does that tell you? It tells you that is the real Islam. Right? Speaking of which, I don't know, I guess it's been a while, since it's been a few weeks since I've had a chance to come and do this show. But I did actually finally finish that, video, which was called The Real Islam, in which I had the most amazing cast of experts. It was Geert Wilders introduced it. Robert Spencer, Bill Warner, just some truly great experts. And the reason that I made this particular video was because of that the first Islamic State video, when they, you know, they released the first thing, which it was 35 minutes of, the first third of it was doctrine. The second third of it was showing them doing what they do, which is killing apostates and so on. And the last third of it was your classic Islamic snuff. It was and fairly horrifying. But the first third of it that was doctrine is the part that I thought was really interesting, is they profoundly changed the nature of the whole Islamic narrative in the world, right? So, anyway, I'll see if the chat rooms. Yeah, there's people here, yay. There is the video called The Real Islam, and we are... You know, I didn't make it to counter what Obama said because, you know, this video was made, was started being made a month before Obama's nonsense about it has nothing to do with Islam. But I got it finished on almost the same day. So, you know, do have a look at that if anybody hasn't seen that particular video, and feel free to comment. I think it's very important. It's an important document. The truth of the matter is, we're not going to be able to fight this thing if we don't admit what it is. And it's like, imagine if we were fighting the Nazis and refusing to admit that Nazism was the doctrine behind Nazi behavior, and it was just a few extremist nutbars that had hijacked Hitler's ideology, even though you could read it right there in Mein Kampf, and that they, you know, the rest of the Nazis were fine people, and, you know, we'd let them all into our countries and they could, you know what I mean? It's the same thing with communism or with Shinto, the Japanese Shinto at the time of World War II. It's completely, it's impossible to fight this thing if you won't even look at it. It just can't be done. If you can't define the enemy, you can't possibly even begin to fight it. And for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, because I just can't let myself believe what looks like is true is true. For reasons that are not entirely clear to me, Obama is not just not allowing us. He's going to a great deal of effort to use to get the FBI not to look at jihad and not to look at any terms which actually put the focus on where it's supposed to be, which is Islam. So, Red, are you there? Hello?
I am here.
Brilliant. How have you got a music clip you could play? I think this would be a great time to take, unless there's any questions in the chat room or if there's anybody calling in, this would be a great time to just to play a short clip and let my voice recover, because I actually still do have a bit of a remnant of a flu. My throat is not working quite right yet. So how about throwing on a music clip or take a short break for a tea, a couple of minutes?
I actually have a clip of you with regarding Stephen Sutliff.
Oh, throw it on.
And ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you back here with Vlad in 2.5 minutes.
The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done, and we act against ISIL, standing alongside others.
I am Stephen Joel Sutliff. I'm sure you know exactly who I am by now and why I am appearing before you. And now, it is time for my message. Obama, your foreign policy of intervention in Iraq was supposed to be for the preservation of American lives and interests. So why is it that I'm having to pay the price of your interference with my life? Am I not an American citizen? You've spent billions of U.S. taxpayers' dollars, and we've lost thousands of our troops in our previous fighting against the Islamic State. So where's the American people's interests in reigniting this war? From what little I know about foreign policy, I remember a time when you could not win an election without promising to bring our troops back home from Iraq and from Afghanistan and to close down Guantanamo. Here you are now, Obama, nearing the end of your term and having achieved none of the above, and deceivingly marching us, the American people, into a blazing fire.
I'm back, Obama. And I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State, because of your insistence in continuing your bombings in Al-Marli, Zumar, and the Mosul Dam, despite our serious warnings. You, Obama, have yet again, through your actions, killed yet another American citizen. So just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people. We take this opportunity to warn those governments who have entered this evil alliance of America against the Islamic State to back off and leave our people alone.
I didn't want to sound too enthusiastic about playing that particular clip, Vlad. And my apologies to your listeners and if that's what it seemed like I was doing. But this is such an important story to all of us, in light, of course, what has been going on in the United States with the Oklahoma beheadings.
Well, see, the thing is, that actually begs another discussion. It has to do with this phenomenon of what the American administration is referring to as lone wolf, about which there's no such thing. There is no such thing as a lone wolf. Is a desperate and feeble attempt to try to convince the world that when someone commits an act of individual jihad, which is they're called upon to do in the freaking Quran, okay, and in Sharia law and so on, Reliance Traveler. But in the Quran, it's called specifically, or it might be Reliance, but it's in one of the most canonical texts of Islam, it's specifically referred to as individual jihad, okay? And it is not unconnected. It is absolutely prescribed for them to do by Islamic doctrine, scripture, and history. So they're trying. When they say lone wolf, it's like, oh, yeah, it's just some freak who just did this individual act. There's no connection to anything. It's really important that we don't fall for it. Again, if you do this, we can't. It's like whack-a-mole. And here's the other thing. Let's just say, and this is a part that kind of breaks my heart in a way. Let's just say that the U.S. administration and various governments, Canadian governments, or especially the British government, let's just say that they really did have the public interest at heart, that they were up to speed, they knew what the problem was, and that they were fighting this war in a clandestine way because they felt that was the best way to do it, and that they're lying to the public and deceiving the public because it's part of a greater strategy. And I've got one of the best readers to my site, a guy named DP111. That's why he refers to himself, right? And he's great. He's a brilliant guy. I love this guy. One of my best readers and commenters. And he's very frequently makes lengthy comments on my site where he says, look, yeah, so you can see that this is happening, that the plan is to do this in order to achieve this end. And, I mean, I don't want to misquote him. So people, if they're interested, they should go search out his comments themselves on my site, and they'll discover that they're very good and they're well-reasoned. And, you know, they may even be true. My problem is the following, that even if it's true, at the end of the day, they're creating their own totalitarian system to fight that one. They're creating a system in where the people have to be lied to at all times, where institutions of state are extremely powerful and then have the ability to, even if they're acting in the best possible manner now, which they are not, by the way, we'll come back to that, but even if they were acting impeccably now, it just takes somebody to take control over these organizations who doesn't have the public's best interests at heart, and then we're under a horrible North Korea-style brutal thing. And don't think it doesn't happen. It's the default. If you look at human history, it's the default position, right? Somebody goes, oh, look, you've handed me this toy. Somebody who doesn't have a conscience, which is quite often the kind of people that find themselves rising to power, will then say, oh, look, I've got this NSA. I've got no such agency. I'm now in control of no such agency. I can listen to and know everything about everybody. Like, how can I not use that to my advantage? Well, you're seeing it already. You know, you're seeing people. Okay, let me just come up with one simple example. A number of years ago, the Canadian government, under Chrétien, did something quite sinister. They made a Canadian long gun or a gun registry. And they made sure that everybody that owned a gun in Canada, that it was registered to this thing, and yada, yada. And it was a bad idea. It was a large step toward a totalitarian state. Well, the Harper government, bless them, saw that for what it was. And they struck down the gun registry, which they were, it was a very brave thing of them to do that, because like Canada's not like the States. We don't have the same sense of individual rights Americans do, where Canadians like live under the delusion that we have, that as long as you don't have the ability to defend yourself, you won't have the need to, right? It's a sad part of Canadian culture. Yeah. But Harper bravely said, look, you can't have this gun registry, goes against basic principles of individual liberty. And he struck it down. And furthermore, he said that no one has the right to use this list. It's now illegal. The gun registry list of gun owners must be destroyed, and no police force, etc., may be in possession of these lists, right? Hopefully everybody's following this. Pretty straightforward so far. Last spring, a town was flooded in Alberta. And the RCMP, which is the Federal Police Force of Canada, I guess somewhat like the FBI, right? Yeah, it's kind of like they're kind of like the FBI. Their jurisdiction is federal. They basically for instance, they can write parking tickets on National Capital Commission land in Ottawa, but nowhere else. I mean, that part's goofy. But anyway, they're a federally mandated police force. What they did is they forced everybody to leave this area that was flooded. Well, that's not that unusual. It's a disaster zone. Police go in and they clear you out. Then they took – what I'm about to tell you is not under dispute. No one is denying that they did this. This is critical. This isn't some conspiracy nut going on about it. Of course, we're past that. These days, the conspiracy nuts are just looking like they were lacking in imagination. Anyway, so the RCMP then took this illegal list, which I say illegal because it was illegal for them to have possession of it, but they did. They still had a copy of the gun registry. And they went to these homes in this town in Alberta, and they kicked the doors in and looted the guns out of these homes. They went in without a warrant, without probable cause, using an illegal list. And I say looted because, geez, I don't know, shucks, gall dang. When I was growing up, I used to say, when people went into a home in a disaster zone and stole your stuff, that was called looting.
Yeah.
Back when I was a boy, mm-hmm. They'd say looters should be shot. So these RCMP went and looted homes and took the stuff. Now, there is something going on. There'll be some token nonsense like there is in Rotherham, England, where some police chief will step down with a $150,000 a year, tax-free salary, and they'll make it look like that's everything's okay now. But so the same thing's going to happen with the RCMP. I'm sure there'll be some minor thing and it'll all blow over. But it shouldn't. These people looted. All the officers who ordered this thing and the officers who obeyed those orders, they should be on charges for looting, for theft, for looting. And nothing short of that should satisfy Canadians because that's what they did. This is unconscionable. Now, that's what happened with just a little bit of information, okay? That's what happened with a little bit. The government was in possession of one bit of information that they weren't supposed to have by law, and then they went ahead and did this thing for political reasons. It was highly manipulative, right? So imagine what the NSA could do when the wrong guy's at the helm, who happens to be at the helm now. But imagine what could happen as it is, they've already caught guys watching their ex-girlfriends or watching their girlfriends and, you know, looking for them, you know, for using these incredible, powerful tools they have to spy on their lovers and who knows what else, right? This is, you know, like the thing, whatever you may say about Ed Snowden, he's revealing some extraordinarily important things to the world about what the American government's doing. There is a Fourth Amendment. That Fourth Amendment should be in effect. It is by law. It's completely insane what's taking place now in the United States. Has anyone seen the movie Brazil? It's a strange sort of George Harrison production. It's kind of like a bizarre version of 1984, where you should see it. If you haven't seen it, it's like a 1970s or 80s. But the basic premise of the thing is that the government in England has taken basically total totalitarian control of the people and their thoughts and their actions through a combination of unions and fear of terrorism. So because they're constantly fighting terrorists, they've taken over control because we've got to stop them terrorists. I mean, at this point, what I'm saying is that the tragedy of this sounds like an incoherent rant, but it isn't. The point I'm trying to make is that the tragedy of the methods that our governments are using to fight terrorism is that I don't know which is worse. The result of the methods we're using to fight it, because we're insisting on pretending it's other than it is, and the consequent totalitarian state we're going to make for ourselves. I mean, what difference does it make if you're in Saudi Arabia or if you're in North Korea? Well, frankly, I'd rather be in Saudi Arabia, at least, like, you can leave. Right? But
are you allowed to leave
North Korea?
Islamic
no.
States?
I certainly
know that you cannot leave North Korea.
You cannot leave North Korea. You certainly can leave.
Punishment.
No, because, you know, the thing is, Islam, okay, this is where it gets a little bit subtle. Islam doesn't recognize borders. They recognize mindsets, right? So they would look at apostasy the same way a North Korean would look at leaving the country, right? A North Korean would say you can't go through this border, you can't leave. You're guilty of, like, treason if you try to escape North Korea, whereas a Muslim would say you're guilty of treason. You can live anywhere you want, providing you're living according to Islamic standards and you're trying to force everybody else to live under Islamic standards. You see?
Oh, yeah.
So that's So, I mean, it's like it's a different abstraction of the exact same idea, though. But, I mean, in terms of physically your body being in Saudi Arabia, it's preferable because you can at least get out, and you can't do so. And both are totalitarian horrific regimes, and we're building one to fight the other, and that's got to be stopped. We can't. It's having the NSA spy on everybody because they don't want to profile, because they, you know, because they say they're fighting terrorism, but terrorism's not an Islamic thing, so we'll just watch everybody then. No. No, that's not okay. It's actually preferable to have a few bombs go off and then have people rise up and say, oh, yeah, this is Islam. We've got to do something about this. And then let the people do it. I don't know what it is the people would do, but the people have been known in the past from time to time to rise up and fight this sort of thing. Right? It's just that our governments are actively trying to stop us from doing that. Our governments feel that's the worst that can happen. Well, no, it isn't. The worst that can happen is that our government ends up creating something just as bad and disenfranchising the individual and disempowering the individual in the name of fighting Islamic terrorism. Well, not even Islamic. Islamisticism terror. So, for the love of God, does anybody have a question?
Yeah, Rita from the chat room has a question. And she is trying to Skype in, and I do not know what's going on with the chat room. The Skype is at the very top of the chat, ladies and gentlemen. But if you want to call in internationally, the international code is 001-347-237-4318. But Rita Lowe, she wants to know, why are even decent conservative politicians like the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott now apes the lie? This has nothing to do with Islam, even though two Australian policemen were attacked by a knife-wielding youth, quote-unquote, a Muslim thug, really, in their police station. Why is it that our authorities are calling these incidents that we're witnessing today referred to as workplace violence and not what it is? And it's Islamic terrorism, Vlad?
Well, actually, that's a surprisingly easy question to answer. If you look at the timeline on certain events, you'll see why that is. If you looked at the Australian Prime Minister, his statements and the things that he did and policy things that he did, he was pretty rational. He was pretty with the program of reality for quite a while. And you can see that he started making these kinds of statements on the same day that he used the word ISIL. Now, just before he started using the word ISIL, and when he seemed to be with the reality program, he was saying Islamic State or ISIS or whatever, right? And using much more rational terms to describe the enemy. So what changed? What changed was that Obama decided to put together this pathetic coalition, right? Like the thing is, Obama's doing the exact same things that Bush did, except not as well and not for the same purpose. It's like Obama does the same things, but like a funhouse mirror version of it. For instance, if you look at the Obama, the Bush version of Fast and Furious, it was a real attempt to stop serious violent crime from Mexico by tracking guns, and it actually worked. And then Obama picked up the exact same program, except did it 10 times harder, and the actual purpose was to create so much gun violence that he would create an appetite for gun control in the States. But he called it Fast and Furious, so it would look like a Bush program. Like Obama is considerably more conniving and evil than I think even some of his critics think. But anyway, so the reason that all of a sudden these people, like the Australian leader and so on, it's because Obama still has cards to play. He can call the Australians and say, look, we've got this trade deal where, you know, we've been picking up 60% of the Australian defense budget. Have you noticed that? Would you like that to continue? Because we can cut that off and we can cut this off and we can create this problem for you with China. So why don't you go with this program? And then suddenly it's like, well, the problem is ISIL, and these deviants who are hijacking Islam, we're going to go and stop them. That's the problem, and it's...
Bingo.
And you know, because you got to look, and you see, it's not that hard to figure out, because you look at the timelines, you look at what these guys said and what they did and what the message was up until a certain moment, and all of a sudden they all started using the word ISIL at the same time. The British, the Australian, even the Canadians started saying ISIL. No one said that. The only guy who said that was Obama. He liked that word ISIL for his own reasons. because he didn't have to say Islamic
really
State.
I was really disappointed in Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper referring to it as ISIL. Disappointed me. And
yeah,
I never thought that Stephen Harper could disappoint me.
We have a free trade deal with the states. That's the first thing, and that could easily be countered. We have the states has so much stuff on us; they could make our life so difficult. How about that pipeline? Do we want that pipeline? How about the pipelines that we do have with the states? Would we want them canceled? Would we like to see? We could, on the strength of the fact that marijuana is basically legal on the West Coast. I wonder what the United States could suddenly make trade impossible. We could say, we've got too much dope coming into our country. We're going to just close our borders down. And he could do it, and he would do it. Like, Obama has leverage still. I mean, he's trying to make the United States not a world power. He's trying to make it into a pretty average place, which is a crying shame for the world, actually. And the world's about to find that out. But as long as he does have the kind of leverage he still has left, what little of it he has left, he's able to use that for purposes that are other than the interests of the states and other countries. And this is how politics is always done. So I'm not saying anything that's revolutionary or even anything that's new. It's just that most people don't think in these terms. This is standard geopolitical wheeling and dealing that goes on. What makes this different than usual is that it's not really – okay, so – geopolitical thought, which is different than political thought. Okay, geopolitical thought is this idea was came up was this Prussian general named Clausewitz or von Clausewitz, and he was this guy that said that geography of a country would determine the policies of that country. And so I don't want to go too deep. I don't want to give a giant. I mean, I'm not Mark Levin or anything, right? So I'm not going to give a huge lesson on this. I don't really know it well enough, the subject. But to give a small example of what geopolitics is as opposed to politics. Geopolitics suggests that in a mountainous region or a mountainous country, the people will always be poor and conservative. Of course, that doesn't apply to California, but there's reasons for that. And in a plains or an oceanfront, people will be liberal and they will be wealthy. And as a matter of fact, that's generally true. And I can give you a couple of contemporary examples where that simple geopolitical fact constantly causes the same problem over thousands of years. And one is China, where the coastal parts of China tends to be, when they're open to trade, the coastal parts of China become very, very wealthy, and they become subject to tons of foreign influence, and it becomes more liberal, and things go well. But then the people from the inner parts of China, which are typically conservative and poor, they lose interest in farming, so they all start moving out to the coastal areas, and then the agrarian roots of China start to fall apart, and so it becomes a near crisis of losing its food supply, and so China cuts off trade from the world because they don't want so the people will all move back and start standing knee deep in the rice paddies again, because that's what keeps the country going. So the country keeps waffling back and forth, China, between being open to the world and closed to the world for reasons of geopolitical reality. Russia, you could say, I don't want to go too deep into it, but Russia has the same, it has to do with defensible borders and a huge amount of territory, which is very difficult to move stuff around in. And I could go on and on. And Iran has mountainous areas. Now, mountainous areas typically are poor because it's hard to move stuff, right? So people are going to be poor,
yeah,
because if you want to get to the store, you can't get in your car and just drive to the store. You have to get your goat and you have to walk half the day. And then you have to walk the other half of the day carrying this stuff on your goat back. And you can't really carry much stuff on a goat. So there's just, you can't get goods to move around. So it's expensive to get. You can't order a pizza for delivery for that same day if you live in, a very mountainous area. And so people tend to be more religious and more traditional if they live in the mountains. And if they live down on the coast, they tend to be less so. I mean, these are just geopolitical reality, right? Okay, so why isn't the world always the same? Well, much of it is, and most of the world does go along the same way because geopolitics is real. It does work. But there's a wild card in there. And what's the wild card? It's ideology. Now and again, you get a guy who's ideologically, geopolitical thought says that whoever's in the White House It doesn't matter because they have to make the same decisions based on the reality they're presented with. Well, that's kind of true. If you look back at the United States from the beginning to whenever, most of the decisions that got made, Lincoln was a huge exception because he had these challenges. So he ended up creating a war which killed more Americans than any other war that ever since, possibly than all of them combined. More Americans died in the Civil War. So he made some different policy decisions. But overall, you could argue that most of the presidents of the United States were very, very similar because geopolitics threw the same choices at them. And you get geopolitical guys, even people I speak to today, that really think Obama's no different than Bush, that was no different than Clinton, that was no different than, based at one level of abstraction.
Insane.
Well, I don't think that's true either. I'll tell you why it's not true. I think that Obama is actually an ideologue. I think the only thing that he said that people should have paid attention to when he was running for office the first time is that he wanted to fundamentally change the United States of America. He was going to enact fundamental change. Thank you for electing me. The United States is the greatest country. Now help me completely change it. No one asked, why would you want to change a place that's the greatest? Well, anyway, they didn't ask, and now they're getting what they get. But he was like Hitler. I'm not trying to compare Obama to Hitler directly. I'm just simply saying they were both ideologues, like Stalin, like Mao. These people were, what made them different than the usual geopolitical leader is they weren't interested in reality. They weren't interested in the results of their policy. They felt that if they were, their policy trumped reality, and if they pushed hard enough for their policy, that they would get the results that they wanted. Now, Obama, he's a different kind of ideologue. He's not even your standard commie that wants this communist utopia. I just think he's postmodernist. I just think he hates the United States. He's like those college students that you run into all the time that run you through circular arguments about how terrible the West is. He's just one of those, and I think he wants to take it down. And the evidence is his first action as president was sending back the bust of Churchill. His first action as president was to insult the United Kingdom, and his second action was to insult Canada. I mean, that's right. He just wanted to show how different he was going to make things. And his first major policy speech was in Cairo, where he demonstrated to the world that his intention was to...
Oh, the Cairo speech. Yeah, exactly. Mubarak was the Egyptian president at the time, was shocked that Obama insisted that the Muslim Brotherhood, which was outlawed in Egypt at the time, be present for his speech, the Cairo speech. Vlad, I have a lot of thoughts. There are so many questions I could ask you. Rita has a really good question in the chat room as well. But I just want to make an observation before I present to you Rita's question. And Barack Hussein Obama's his slogan in 2008 was hope and change. I think that he was throwing in a bit of a red herring with that one because we didn't get hope, but we sure got a lot of change.
That's right. I think, look, if I used to subscribe to a geopolitical think tank called Stratfor. And Stratfor is it's just a condensed two-word strategic forecasting, right? Excuse me. Now, Stratfor used to be very good. When I read it, it was almost elated because it was like reading the news back when CBC was good. Like when I was a kid and I used to listen to CBC and it was without bias and it was straight news and straight information and well presented and well reasoned and it wasn't editorialized. And I used to read Stratfor before Obama was elected with a great deal of joy. Like it was like good geopolitical analysis of stuff, and they'd do like what they call sit reps, which would be a situation report, which is the kind of thing that a president would see every hour from the CIA, right? These sit reps showing, you know, this thing has just happened. This bomb went off. This event happened. This meeting just happened between the foreign minister of this country and the prime minister of that country. Whatever, sit reps, right? And it would show you all these sit reps, and it would give you analysis, and it was really good. And it would show you, like, I kept them all. Everything I got from Stratfor was like a gem. And I say it was great. History of Pakistan, showing the geopolitics of Pakistan. I didn't know, for instance, that Pakistan isn't even a real word. It's just like an amalgam of all these different tribes that happened to be in the area when they kind of tossed this country together, the Pashtun and the something and the something and the something. And that anyway, this analysis explained a great deal of the reality of Pakistani existence based on geopolitical thought, like what tribes were there and what was the terrain like and so on and so on. But then something happened after Obama was elected, and it was actually significant. I noticed that the language changed and that it started to adopt the official language that Obama was demanding of the media, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I started to become a little bit more suspicious about the information that I was buying from Stratfor. Then one day, within an hour or 2 hours of each other, I got two sit reps. One sit rep was about a Boko Haram attack that had killed a large number of people. This is all on my blog, by the way. I put screen caps of the two sit reps beside each other. And one of them was, I think it was Boko Haram that had killed a whole bunch of people, and it referred to a militant attack in Nigeria where a certain number of people had been killed. And it was extremely neutrally worded. It referred to them as militants, not terrorists, even though any rational definition of terrorism would be a bunch of armed guys killing a bunch of unarmed Christians while they're at a church praying, okay? And it worded it very neutrally. Several Boko Haram militants attacked a church in Nigeria, killed something like 180 people or something, whatever it was. And that was the sit rep. And then an hour later, I get one about France. And this sit rep was about a group called... Also, a fantastic group of guys in France. I even made up a T-shirt with their logo on it. It'll come to me. I bet you Rita knows the name I'm talking about. Anyway, this great group, and they went to this mosque that's being built, this huge mega mosque in Tours, which is at the site of a great battle where the French fought off, several centuries ago, the French fought off a previous attack by Muslims where they tried to take over France. And this group stood around, this particular French group of youth, and they sang some songs about, French nationalism, and they did some really clever chants. I mean, not like the kind of chants we're used to hearing. They did it the way French people do stuff. So it had style, it had class, and even a little bit of humor, right? It had some chants with some syncopated clapping, and the police came, and the police said, disperse and go home. And you know what this group did? They dispersed and they went home, all right? But if you read the Stratfor sit rep, it said a group of far-right national extremists went to this mosque and did this horrible thing. Now, I'm not looking at the sit rep net right now. But if you look at the two side by side, you would swear on your great-grandmother's grave that what happened in France was infinitely worse than what happened in Nigeria. So the group that was opposing the mosque, the building of the mosque at Tours, where they did a little chant, did a little dance, mm-hmm. clapped their hands a little, and then went home the first time the French authorities asked them to, without a single bit of violence, according to Stratfor, was suddenly the greater evil. Now that is what happened after Obama took over. Even Stratfor's sit reps changed. Now and again, they try to get me to resubscribe, and I send them back a link to those two with a little LOL. Because they're no longer what they used to be, the greatest thing. By now, there may be other, I think there are, other geopolitical think tanks that are really fantastic that people should find and subscribe to that do proper neutral reporting. Like, you're not going to see, like, necessarily counter-jihad-style reporting because they don't analyze it that way. But you'll at least get straight news, unlike you get from Western media, most of which have been even including Fox to a degree, has been utterly hijacked by rules that were created by the Obama administration. Now, remember, the Obama administration is a group of people that were caught outright, and they were caught, busted, and exposed for bugging all of the phones from the White House for media. They were bugging and tapping the phones for, CNN and Fox and whoever else. They said, the media, even the media that was friendly to Obama said, what are you doing? How could you do this? This is amazingly undemocratic. And yet they still backed the guy. Something really bad is going on. You know what? We're 9:34.
Rita has been very, very proactive with the program. She brings up so many salient questions. One in particular Vlad, that I'm wondering if we can address, you can address, and that she has many questions, but this one I find very, very intriguing. Are there going to be any candidates for the next president of the United States that can ensure the safety of our civilization? Are there any candidates out there in the United States? Because it's very important to us because we see the United States as a superpower, of course. And the United States, as it goes, so does the rest of us. And it's a shameful that it comes to that. But if the United States falls, we are going to fall like dominoes. Is there anybody in the United States, Vlad, that can restore the United States to its glory and ensure a sense of security globally?
Well, let's put it this way. Pierre Trudeau, whatever you may think of him, once talked about being Canada being next to the United States was a little like being in bed with an elephant. Are you there? Okay.
Yeah,
so,
I am.
Excuse me. And that's true. It's like a small person in a queen size bed next to a full grown elephant. And so whether they're friendly or not, whether that elephant is friendly or not, every twitch, every grunt, every passing of wind is going to be of tremendous significance to you, you know, no matter how much it may like you. So you're absolutely right. I mean, from the Canadian point of view, what's going on should concern Canadians much more. Sadly, most Canadians, I mean, I've often said that Canada's number one export is not oil, it's sanctimony. And, you know, when I go running, excuse me, I am sorry, I'm still sick. When I go running, I often pass
Canadian... I know, and
we're going
to take a break in a moment so you can catch your breath.
When I go running, I often pass cars that have Obama Biden stickers on them, and this is with Ontario license plates. So, I mean, I just find the degree of sanctimony, it raises temperature much worse than global warming does. You're getting these people who want to advertise their moral superiority by having stickers for people they can't possibly vote for. I mean, these are Canadian residents, right? Anyway, it's quite sad. So many Canadians just love to be supportive of Obama, and it just makes them feel really good about themselves. So they, you know, Canadians don't really get the danger that we're in. Obama, for instance, has specifically turned down this pipeline from the oil sands, which would guarantee the security of the states and the wealth of Canada, right? This one deal where all they had to do was say yes, they wouldn't be paying more for oil. They'd probably be paying less for it. They'd be reducing the amount of greenhouse gas, right? Why? Because if you get your oil from Canada and it goes through a pipeline, you get every gallon at a cost of probably, you know, one quarter cup of oil per gallon, the cost of getting it there. When you have to ship it over from Saudi Arabia, it would probably cost you a half a gallon per gallon, right?
Yeah.
On the shipping alone. So think how much more for people who believe in that greenhouse gas. I don't happen to personally. But speaking to anybody that thinks that burning fossil fuels is a problem. So, you see, but Obama specifically wanted to guarantee the wealth of the Saudis and all that money, because he really wants to move the United States closer into the Islamic orbit. Like, one thing I'll give Obama, other than the other actors in the general political world, is that Obama understands that there is an Ummah, and that the Ummah supersedes national borders. And other leaders don't get that. They're still looking at an old-fashioned map saying, oh, yeah, that's Jordan, that's Syria. And, you know, to some extent the map applies. But really, really, it's not. And Obama knows that, and he wants to move the United States closer to the Islamic world. He thinks that's the future. And he's ready to sacrifice Canada, Great Britain, Israel, everybody who actually does anything to do it. And he's making a mistake. It's not in America's interest to do that. But that's what he's doing. And is there another candidate in the wings that'll change anything? I highly doubt it.
And that's how I feel, too. Do you want to take a bit of a break?
You know what? I got to say, I've, as always, enjoying this so much. But between the fact that we're already over an hour and that I'm still pretty sick
And I've got an unbelievable amount of editing ahead of me. I think I might have to cut it here. But can we pick this up next week?
We sure can. And
okay.
Believe me, Vlad, this has been a wonderful, wonderful program. You have answered so many questions, and Rita has been so instrumental in the chat room in presenting the questions and offering up for discussion. So we really want to thank you, Rita.
Rita has done an unbelievable amount of hard work for the Counter Jihad. She has subtitled and helped translate. She's translated and helped subtitle so many videos from German and French. Much of what everybody who's listening to this has seen in terms of videos out of Germany, Austria, France, and even Quebec is because of Rita's hard work and selflessly, and she works at it. I mean, like hours and hours and hours of hard work, and she, you know, and she pays for her own equipment to do it. It's like she trust me, Rita's one of the great ones. So, there. Just so you know. Anyway, good night, and I hope to see everybody next week. Thanks for listening. Please read my site, VladTepesBlog.com, and leave comments because if it is without comments, I have no idea if anyone's paying attention. So it's always good to see.
They are. They're paying attention.
Red, thank you so much for doing this. I know you also are a selfless and tireless worker for the Counter Jihad, and you host so many radio shows, and you know, like, it's like, you know, you should think of yourself like Winston Churchill when nobody knew what was going on, and he was like one of the very few people that knew the Nazis were a problem. He had his own radio program, and he broadcasted out there every chance he got. He even stole government documents and read them out loud on the radio to because he needed people to understand the threat. And so don't think this doesn't matter. It does. Thanks, everybody. I got to go. I'm really starting to wind down. Good night.
Absolutely. Good night, everybody. Thank you so much for joining Vlad this evening.